You see a funnel drop off, you figure out your hypothesis, and then none of the tests that you do actually move the number. A lot of it has to do with onboarding. Why can't we get right. more people to engage with the product? Why are they dropping off? It's so easy. Like, look at this. You just need to click on this button.
Hello, and welcome to How Things Grow. How Things Grow is a podcast about growth and the people who drive it. Join me, your host, Shamant Rao, as I speak with some of the smartest people in tech and go behind the scenes of growth trajectories of companies and technologies that power our world today. We dive into the stories of many of these growth leaders and their companies. We talk about origins, early victories, strokes of luck, troughs of failure, and much more, and deconstruct many of the things they do to drive dramatic growth for their companies and technologies. How Things Grow is presented by me, Shamant Rao, CEO of the mobile user acquisition firm Rocketship HQ. I'm supported today by Catherine Fung, our audio producer. My guest today is Elena Werner. Elena is a growth advisor. She advises a number of companies and helps scale businesses with marketing, product, analytics, and growth. Elena joined SurveyMonkey as an analyst a year and a half out of college and found herself trying to understand a growth trajectory that was incredible. Yet, this was also a growth trajectory that no one on the team really had any insight into. As an analyst, Elena wrote the queries that helped answer many of the fundamental questions underlying the business and what was driving its growth. Over the next 7 years, Elena grew to become the SVP of growth. In her next role, Elena became the SVP of marketing, product, design, and growth at the cybersecurity company Malwarebytes. And much like at SurveyMonkey, she helped drive an understanding of exactly what was driving growth in a business where there was very little understanding of this. In this interview, Elena talks about what she learned as she grew with the business, how she learned that not every problem could be solved through quantitative optimization, how she learned to trust her team and lead, about the death of the person who inspired her the most, about how she breaks down and understands the drivers of growth, and much, much more. I'm very excited to welcome Elena Werner to How Things Grow. Elena, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's an honor to have you. Elena, when you joined SurveyMonkey, you guys were a very small team. I believe it was in the low double digits in terms of the number of employees. Selena Tobacco-Walla, who was on this podcast and who recommended you for the show, she said her first impression of SurveyMonkey was one of disbelief. She was like, "Surveys? You're kidding, right?" Almost as if it couldn't be a real business. So what were your first impressions of the company when you joined?
So I joined SurveyMonkey only a year and a half out of school. And my first position was with Safeway in their marketing department, which is a very large grocery store in the United States. So when I was applying to SurveyMonkey, I just really wanted to get into tech because I wanted to be in a company that is very small, that is very agile, that has a startup mentality. SurveyMonkey attracted me from the beginning. A, I used the product, and that was a huge positive. And I've used it in school. I've used it. I've seen it. I've taken surveys from other companies that would send out customer satisfaction surveys. So that's a connection that I was very important to me. That's something that I could relate to and something that I've known and experienced before. But when I started, I remember my first couple of interviews at SurveyMonkey, I was very impressed by the volume of the company as a whole in terms of how many customers it actually has and how small the team was at the same time. So that imbalance was something that was very special because usually at that volume, there's already very large business and very large company built around it. Yeah. But it was a very special timing in SurveyMonkey when I joined back in 2009. It was ability to build a business from ground up on something that is already functioning on a very large scale.
And according to my research, even though it was growing that fast and it was at a substantial scale with such a small team, there wasn't quite a lot of insight into what was driving this growth. How did your team start to figure out why this is happening, where this growth is coming from?
Yeah, and that's why my position as a data analyst at SurveyMonkey when I joined was the best one from my perspective to be at. Because I remember still writing my first query against the database. What's the average number of responses a survey gets? Some of the fundamental questions about the business, they had no idea what was doing because the product was just so well adapted and it was growing like crazy. But it was very exciting to be in a position where I was actually putting some of this framework around it of why the company is growing the way that it's growing. Where is the growth coming from? Yeah. Most importantly, where are the opportunities to unlock additional growth can come from? And data was at the core center of it. So data was sitting at the decision table every single time any discussion was happening, because we really wanted to understand the quantitative aspect of how people interacted with the product in order for us to move forward and come up with a strategy that was local to SurveyMonkey and that emphasized what already worked and really focused on improving anything that we believed was worth going after.
Yeah. So it sounds like you were answering some very fundamental questions. What, if anything, surprised you at the time when you were answering these questions, like how many responses does a survey get?
Some of the things that surprised me, I was just remember being blown away by scale. So not only in terms of number of accounts, the new ones that were created, where they were coming from, nobody knew where is all of this acquisition coming from. But more importantly, the vast spread of how many respondents were touched by the surveys.
Right.
So millions and billions of responses that were coming into the platform, and the spread and the network effect that was created with the product was just completely astonishing. And I think the company knew pretty well, obviously, around their subscription metrics and about their financials. But in terms of actual actual usage metrics and information that they were actually digesting, how much they were a data company, as much as the online survey tool, is something that was surprising to us all.
Got it. You've said every day I live in the world of data, growth, and product, and some nights too. You've also spoken about how you've used qualitative research and surveys to inform product decisions and growth decisions. And as somebody who started working on data as an analyst, what was it like just for you to personally to start to learn and understand the qualitative aspects of growth?
Yeah, I started my career in a quantitative, and quantitative, I think, is a wonderful way to understand what is going on. So you need, if you want to understand your history, if you want to understand how your customers are actually interacting with the product, it's the best way to do it. And it's the way to really take in everything that is happening and build on top of it, as opposed to making assumptions that you don't really necessarily need to make. The qualitative is starting to really answer why. And to me, qualitative has always been a voice of the customer. So you see their actions, and then you get an overlay of why they're doing it and their perception of it. And that is a really two-sided coin. Can you make a lot of decisions on the quantitative? Absolutely. A lot of optimization decisions are being done on the quantitative insights. But can you make a strategy decision without understanding why customers are doing what they're doing? Almost no. So you have to take the two into account. And I think it's actually very dangerous to only take one in the account and make a lot of long-term decisions, because A, on the quantitative, you can pigeonhole yourself into something, not think really outside of the box. On the qualitative, very important to understand what customers want out of your product, but at the same time, if you don't marry it with the actions that actually happen in the product, it can also lead you in the very wrong direction. So understanding how the usage is going on via quantitative, and then why it's happening through the voice of customer via qualitative, really creates a very well-painted picture in terms of what are the, all of the inputs you need to make in terms of your decision-making, and then go from there. Now, I'll give you like very specific examples. So for pricing page. People are converting on pricing page, let's say at a certain amount. Let's say 15% of them move into the checkout page. Why did the others not do it? Or why did the ones that picked the plan did it? And just understanding of who placed an order and why they placed it, as opposed to looking at specific features that they used, because there's more hypothesis that you can build in terms of how you can improve that experience by hearing their decision-making, not just looking at the data and seeing what they're doing.
And as somebody who started in the world of data,
was there an inflection point that made you realize, oh, asking questions about how and the qualitative aspects is just as important, when you realize, oh, I need to actually pay attention to this part of the picture too?
Yes, a lot of it came just from not being able to move the numbers. You see a funnel drop off, go into figure out your hypotheses, and then none of the tests that you do actually move the number. A lot of it has to do with onboarding. Why can't we get more people to engage with the product? Why are they dropping off? It's so easy. Like, look at this. You just need to click on this button. But hearing customers that are experiencing that product for the very first time, they may be afraid to click the button, hearing the hesitation and hearing the uncertainty, or knowing how high intent is your user base that is coming through versus is it low intent and they need a little bit more hand-holding and explanation, really helps you come up with experiences that are truly incredible for your users that match where they're coming from and address their needs, as opposed to you basically addressing your own needs.
Certainly, I've been guilty of making decisions by spreadsheets.
Everybody does. Like, we think that we represent the masses, but at the end of the day, I feel like anytime you work at the company for maybe longer than 3 months, you no longer represent your customer base, because you start having a tunnel vision in terms of what you think in the product that is described internally. So connecting with the customers and going through experiences over and over again becomes extremely important.
Yeah, certainly. And SurveyMonkey grew substantially, even though it was already pretty big when you joined. And how did your work change as the company grew? How did your different areas of focus change?
So for me personally, as I mentioned before, I really started in data analytics. So my first order of business was understanding what is happening and try to put it in the numbers so we can start driving predictability. So we know what's going on. We can understand some of the correlations and we know the drivers of our business as they show through the data. As it evolved and as we actually started building all of the teams, it became a lot more of what to do with that data and how do we iterate on that data with our assumptions? How do we evolve the experience and how do we continue growing with our users so we continue to delight them? I mean, obviously, the discovery in terms of what is happening continues, but we started going a lot more into causality testing of is this correlation actually a causation? So if we increase this, will the other metric increase as well? So for example, if we increase pricing page views, will orders go up as well? Or that's actually not going to happen because there's not much causation between the additional traffic that was sending through it. So there's some causation, but not all of it. Or if we increase number of signups that are coming in at the end of the survey, does that increase our activation? And does that increase our conversion? So we started testing a lot of it to try to understand how people would interact with slightly different flows, because product was very lean and it performed very well and it was so easy to use. So it was always a very delicate balance of how do you keep that that core value, yet continuously try to improve everybody's journey, because there's such a wide variety of use cases that, that is going through the experience. And as you start to build a lot more teams, how do you collaborate with all of those teams that are starting from scratch? How do you enable them and maintain that culture of data-driven and growth mindset throughout the entire company so we can continue moving forward and all speak the same language?
Right. Yeah, it sounds like there was much more nuance to how growth happens as you grew, as the team grew, and as you grew as well with the team. You know, Alina, you mentioned that your professional role model was Dave Goldberg, who is the former CEO of SurveyMonkey. And certainly he's somebody who's spoken about with much reverence in Silicon Valley, including Selena Tobacco-Walla, who spoke about him in this podcast. What are some of the ways in which working with Dave impacted you? What were some of the things you learned?
Dave is somebody that I still think to this day, almost every single day, in terms of somebody that I aspire to be. He was the CEO that created a culture in the company that really pushed people to their limits while enabling them. So the mentorship that everybody got that interacted with him, but at the same time, the high bar that you had to perform against when interacting with him is is something that was very special. And the amount of understanding that he had in every single area of the business, something that blew everybody's minds off. You can go up and show him a small Excel spreadsheet with nitty-gritty details of the, let's say, onboarding details across different use cases and how they activate by use case, how they convert by use case. And he'd be able to grasp it in just a second. And not only grasp it, but make a decision of what actually this data means and how to interpret it and what are the next steps should be it, or find a mistake in it in something that I've been looking for hours and hours and hours. And I thought I've checked and cross-checked and triple-checked everything. And he'd take him a second to find an issue because he just had such a great ability to take all of the facts, put them together, see if it makes sense, and make a decision off of it. And this is something that I've aspired to, especially in the data world, of how do you interpret the data. Plus, he showed the leadership qualities that I've always aspired to have, even myself as I started managing people and as I started leading the teams. Because once you see an amazing leader, the best that I could do is pick up those qualities, localize them for myself, and do that to other people. Even after his passing, we made the t-shirt that said, hashtag make Dave proud, in terms of how do you go through your daily decision-making process. And even as we still get together with the team, we talk about him sometimes in terms of what he's done and how it impacts our lives. And that's something that I will cherish for the forever.
Certainly, you know, I haven't had firsthand interactions with him, but from a lot of people I know that have worked with him, he definitely seems to be a truly inspirational person. And Dave did pass away very unexpectedly, and that happened while he was the CEO of SurveyMonkey. What was it like for the team to face something so unexpected? And what was it like for you?
The only word I can say was devastating. I remember receiving a call on the weekend when that happened, and I was in disbelief. I had no emotion. And when I went back to work on Monday, the moment I got in my car, I just completely broke down. So it was something that I wasn't willing to accept until it was time for me to actually face the reality. But he held us as a glue together. But at the same time, he built an incredible succession plan, and he built an incredible team around him. So even though it felt like we removed an engine out of the car, the engine itself was actually us, and we continued moving forward. Yeah. So company continued moving forward. Really, the biggest loss was personal loss, because we could no longer interact with him. We could no longer learn from him. We could no longer be inspired by him. So that piece was something that really hit every single person that SurveyMonkey hard.
Certainly. Just the fact that it was so unexpected can have been so hard to deal with. But the fact that you and many other people seek to channel what they've learned from him speaks to the legacy that he's left.
Exactly.
And to switch gears a little bit, while you were working at SurveyMonkey, you would create a SurveyMonkey account pretty much every day. Tell us about this practice and what inspired this.
Yeah, as we answer some of the very fundamental questions about user behavior within the product, one of the things that I found myself feeling is almost disconnected from our users. Mm-hmm. When we're trying to understand why a certain trend was happening in our numbers, let's say in number of surveys created, why are they going down? Why are there fewer questions on the surveys? I didn't know how to answer it very well, and I could look at the numbers all day long and try to find a solution. But what I found that was a lot more impactful is really to put that new user hat on and try to do it all over again. Sure. And try to find a different flow that I haven't done before, and try to come up with it as I'm a head of HR trying to do an employee engagement survey, or I'm trying to create a market research survey, and go through the flow. What I found was very interesting. First of all, it kept me close to the product. If you can dog feed your product as much as possible in your daily work, the better it is, because you're actually interacting with it and you truly understand what is happening in the platform as all of the pieces fall together. But SurveyMonkey, it was not the product that I could send a survey every single day to somebody. So creating an account and at least trying to create a survey every single day was very important to me, as keeping close tabs of the experience that was constantly evolving. We had an amazing product and engineering team that was pushing the envelope and pushing that experience forward. And for me to stay on top of it, I had to be in the product. And the way to be in the product, I would come in every single morning. I would look at my numbers. How many new paid subscribers do we have? What's the churn? How many new accounts? How many surveys are sent? And then I would create an account right afterwards. It would not take more than 5 to 10 minutes, but it kept me close and grounded to our customers with what they're facing on day-to-day basis. More importantly, it actually helped me think about where should we look into them, into the different funnels. Because I would get myself into a certain situation in the product, and I'm like, I wonder how many people get here, because this is very confusing. Is this something that I should be pitching to product to fix? Or I would find bugs. I was very close friends with QA, because I would go through it so many times. I'm like, hey, this is not working correctly, and this is not working correctly. Yeah. Or I would find an opportunity to come up with very interesting analysis to help the team understand the behavior and how people are actually progressing through the product. Because it's very easy to say, okay, this is surveys, this is new orders, this is pricing page visits. But how many people interact with this feature? And how do them do it on the first survey versus second? Out of them convert that, don't convert, on customer satisfaction use case versus employee engagement use case. And it helps us connect the dots and really paint a picture about who's doing what. And those hypotheses, those ideas, I always got by going through the product. So it wasn't just me sitting and thinking of, okay, what else can I do? I would just go in the product and say, okay, what would be interesting to understand? And how can we help our users better? But that's the only way that I found myself being, aside of talking to customers, but actually feeling as close to a customer as I can, especially a couple years in, where, again, you become disconnected.
Sure. And you did mention that while you were starting off at SurveyMonkey, you were a frequent user. And it's so easy to build a disconnect with the users and build empathy with them. So it sounds like you made a very conscious decision to really understand what the customer experience was like, even as you grew within the company.
Exactly. And it helped me, A, interpret the data. It helped me as I grew into product management and marketing roles to be able to find the right customers, to be able to deliver incredible experiences to them. Because I try to wear their shoes and every single day and try to figure out what would they like? What would they find delightful? Because what would I at least find delightful in this experience? Exactly. And let's go figure out and test it.
Sure. And as you grew personally into leadership roles, what were some of the things that you had to change about how you approached your work? How did you learn some of these things?
I think the biggest one was not trusting others. And I went into management not really probably fully understanding what managing team really means. It took me a while to understand I can only be successful if my team is successful. So I can only be as good as they are. I cannot plug for them. I cannot do work myself for them. I have to trust them. I have to enable them. I have to push them, but provide a very solid safety net and help them brainstorm and be the best version of themselves. And I have to allow them to fail. And I have to be okay with that. And I have to support them through that, to iterate them and for them to get better. But it took me a while. I remember my first managing role was managing analytics team, and I remember still writing a lot of queries doing a lot more additional detail on the analysis, even rewriting some of the team's emails that they were going to send out. At some point, I figured out, listen, for me to scale, I have to step back. I have to build a succession plan for me immediately so for I can take on different roles and I can continue evolving myself as a leader and be involved in the projects that I'm not so comfortable doing. So, but that transition probably took me a year or so, and I'm very thankful to my team for sticking with me through it because they supported me and they helped me through it. Was their peer at first, and then I became a manager, which also was a difficult transition. But at the same time, I've learned so much, again, looking at Selena Tabakawala, looking at Dave Goldberg in terms of how do they lead their teams? How do they push them? And I started absorbing those traits as much as possible to say, what I like in my management, because if I like it, I want to propagate it onto other people on my team and around me as much as possible, because I only want to treat people as I want to be treated, and I want to be given freedom, and I want to be pushed, and I want to learn. So that's the type of environment that I'm going to provide for my team. But don't get me wrong, management of people is not something that I would wish on my worst enemy, unless it's something that they actually wanted to do, because it's a tough switch from individual contributor role to management, and so many people go into it for the wrong reasons, because that's what they believe that they should be doing, that's not what they want to do, because leadership is tough. It's really tough. It comes with glory of seeming to own some of the outcomes that are happening and wins, but it comes with a very dark side of true people management, failures, iteration, learning, trust, and all of those skill sets is very difficult to do in a way that enables people as opposed to beats them down.
Certainly, I can relate to a lot of that, because I started my company like 9 months ago, and let's just say I've slept not as much as I slept before that. So it's certainly a challenge that I'm learning to deal with myself, and it's a ongoing process. So I definitely appreciate what you said.
And it's your baby, so it's hard to also give it up for somebody else to take care of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What's keeping me learning, even though I have very little conventional leadership experience before I started the company. Absolutely what you said.
But I think it's important to also understand that you don't need to have a conventional leadership experience to be a great manager. It takes time to actually learn from your mistakes, and that's what makes people great managers. So I've seen people that have been in the management for decades, and I've seen people that have only done it for 6 months. And I've seen 6 months that can be just as impactful as a decade if you have the right skill set and you have the right drive and traits to really become a great manager.
Absolutely. So, Elena, after many years at SurveyMonkey, you moved to your next role at Malwarebytes. Can you tell us what Malwarebytes is and what inspired your move?
Yes, Malwarebytes is a cybersecurity company that provides an endpoint agent. So an agent that you'd install on your device, whether it's Windows, Mac, iOS, or Android device, that's two things. Freemium version scans and remediates for any malicious threats that you might have, trackers, viruses, malware, ransomware, in terms of figuring out what is actually going on with your device and there's anything that is either bogging it down or slowing it down, or actually are you being hacked and tracked and isn't your information being resold somewhere. And then the protection offering, which is their subscription offering, really prevents it from happening again. So it's a proactive protection from you getting infected in the future from any of these malicious threats.
Got it. And I understand that when you came into Malwarebytes, it was in a very similar stage that SurveyMonkey was in when you joined, which is that it was growing like crazy and it had a really small team and there wasn't really a lot of understanding of why this growth was happening and how this growth was happening. So
yes, the biggest similarities were that the company was almost 10 years old already. So same as SurveyMonkey when I joined. The revenue-wise, millions and millions of dollars are already being made, and the growth is there, and it's very organic because it happened very slow through freemium in both cases. So it wasn't accelerated growth push, so it really found a way to get to the level very sustainably and very organically. The difference actually is in team sizes, because at SurveyMonkey, there was only a couple dozen people when I joined. Malwarebytes was already a couple hundred people. At the time that I was joining, and it had a very accentuated business lens of both consumer and enterprise. So from that perspective, they still had a lot more to do to become data-driven. They had a lot more to do to understand what is actually happening and where their growth is happening. And that's the piece that was exciting to me, because you have a very strong product market fit, you have a very strong adoption, and to really scale that adoption and to be able to predict that growth going forward, that's where I love getting involved, in terms of really, really creating a playbook of what's next for the company and how can you pull on the right levers and prioritize your most precious resources to be applied to the right initiatives.
Sure. And correct me if I'm wrong, but my research tells me there really wasn't any structured thinking around growth or growth practices when you came in. So I would imagine part of your first challenge was to really get buy-in around this is how growth needs to look like. This is how we need to approach it. What was the process of getting that buy-in like? What were some of the challenges you faced, if any, at the time?
Right. So I joined Malwarebytes on the executive team as a head of growth. And that was the first growth function that they've ever had. They have very strong self-serve business. And I'm really responsible for growing that self-serve business. Now, the buy-in, the easiest one was the fact that CEO was very much bought into it. He really wanted me to join the team and partner with him and help company grow. So that's a must. In terms of the team, they were very open to a growth mindset as a practice. And I should say what growth mindset means for me. So growth mindset for me is really all about making decisions that are data-informed, qualitative or quantitative, and positioning everything, single activity that you do on the team to be outcome-based. So you create a hypothesis right from the beginning. I'm going to do this, and I think this is what I'm going to get in return. And we're going to prioritize our activities, whether it's marketing or product, it doesn't really matter, based on where we believe the biggest outcome is. The outcome is derived based on the data analysis that you do of what you think, why would you even do this activity? What do you think the opportunity is? And then you actually measure and you try to understand, was my hypothesis correct? If it's not correct, which most of the time it's not correct, why? Can we improve it to get to the hypothesis level in terms of the impact? Or is it something that we need to move on? So it's that very scientific method of let's understand what's happening, create some assumptions on top of it. But most importantly, as we start making activities around those assumptions, let's measure them. And let's see if we did it, should we be doing it again? Many times in the companies, especially as they start getting big and after they approach product market fit, teams start being process oriented. They have an item, they have a feature, they release, and then they move on to the next thing. And how do you take a step back and say, well, why did you do it in the first place? What did you think it's going to get? Yeah. And the roadmap should not finish with the release. The roadmap should finish with what's the outcome? How many users did you affect with it? How many users engaged with it? What was the monetary impact or engagement impact? And that mentality is really difficult sometimes to implement if people are not comfortable with data, if people are pressured to just release as opposed to drive outcomes, and different ways of incentivizing teams also are sometimes prevent you from getting the alignment across the organization to be an outcome-driven organization. Sure. So growth to me, growth, listen, everybody's supposed to be responsible for growth. Otherwise, why are you working in the company? You're working in the company to make it grow. But growth mindset and what growth team is supposed to evangelize is how do you connect what you're doing on day-to-day to an outcome that results in the growth of the company, which is both user base and the revenue base, because those two have to come hand in hand.
Sure. And it's so easy for a company in its early stage that is very outcome focused to become process focused. So I can certainly see the challenges with that. And I do like the phrase you used about the scientific method, because in generations before ours, what everything you described was basically called the scientific method. And now we are applying it to driving technological change, driving outcomes in tech. And I think that's a very interesting adaptation of, I think, what's perhaps a rather old concept. Right? To switch gears a little bit, you've spoken about your work at Malwarebytes. You've spoken about the persona of a type of user that was pivotal to the early growth of Malwarebytes. Can you speak about this persona and how you guys zeroed in on it?
Yeah, one of the first questions that I ask of any company that I talk to is, why are you growing right now? What is happening? Who is the main user you're developing to right now? Who is the user you want to develop to 3 years from now? Are they the same? Are they different? And one of the things that Malwarebytes, again, very organic company, very organic growth, when we asked about where are these installations coming from? Where is the downloads coming from? Who who's driving it? And there were a lot of hypotheses of who it is, because what the company was built for from the beginning was a fairly technical person that knew exactly what was going on. And that's why they actually chose Malwarebytes over any other cybersecurity product out there, because it zeroed in and focused on the areas of your machine that actually mattered, and that zeroed in on threats that actually mattered. So extremely relevant, as opposed to being bloated and trying to solve every single problem in the world on your device. So that's the person that they built for at the beginning. The question is, 10 years later, is that still the person that we're building for?
Right.
So we very quickly, just for us to understand, who are we talking to? Like, who are our users? We went into a lot of user research, and we ran a lot of surveys. We got a lot of user interviews. We had a user research person that was going through cluster analysis to come up with three personas that we had in our user base that everybody kind of resonated with. And we created Facebook profiles of those people. They had names, they had pictures in front of them, they had all of their traits, what they like, what they don't like, that you described them. So it helped us humanize our users and talk about them in terms of who are we building for and who's actually driving our growth. And what we found was fascinating. So what we call is home CTO. That's the technical person that the product was built from at the beginning. So think of that friend that is very tech savvy, that if you have any issue, you probably will call them to ask of what's going on. And they were still a major use case for Malwarebytes, which was great. That means we still retained our technical audience. More importantly, where growth came from is them referring other people to Malwarebytes. So right. When somebody reached out to them and said, hey, I have an issue, please help me, because they're their friend, they said, just go download Malwarebytes and they will fix your problems most likely. And if it doesn't, then call me back. And that was actually the growth loop of the product, where that referral. So home CTOs were extremely valuable to us, and we continued building all of the products for them, because they, instead of us having to spend a lot of money in acquisition and trying to capture every single person out there, we were referred to people by somebody that they've trusted, because we developed product that can be trusted by technicians and home CTOs, and that was extremely important to us. So we put that person in the table in every single decision making that we've had for our product, for our design, for our go-to-market. Will they like it? Is it for them? Because it's our most important to acquire them, and they will help us and aid us to help us get spread across their network. So, but knowing that helped us understand who we're building for, and what's the right language to use, and how to not to alienate them. Yes, it's a mass market cybersecurity product, which is great, but at the same time, we cannot go too mass market, because we have to maintain this technical use case, which is at our core and at our heart of everything that we do. And we would never sacrifice those values to gain really any other user.
So because you identified the home CTO as a core persona that is important to the product, you were like, right, we are not going to dumb the product down.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Will we make it easy to use for everybody? Yes.
Right.
Will it have a technical aspect of it for that home CTO to really drill in into everything that's going on? Yes. And we will never give that up, because it is something that is at our core of our DNA, and it's something that it differentiates us a lot from a lot of the other cybersecurity products out there.
Sure. And that's a very subtle nuance. But sounds like that's exactly the kind of nuance that would make a lot of difference to how the product eventually grows.
Exactly. Right. And then the design and an evolution, because you'd say, okay, nobody's using this feature. Let's just rip it out. Maybe home CTO are the only ones that are using this feature, and it's not coming out. Will it be, for example, selected by default? Maybe not, if 99% of the people are not using it. But if it's important to them, it stays, period. Right. So, it became a major decision maker in a lot of the research that we've done around either defaults or feature adoption, feature placement, and design.
You did mention that home CTO was one of the three personas you came up with. What was the process of arriving at the home CTO or the other three personas? Because I asked this because I would imagine, just very anecdotally, among the people I know, the number of people that I could classify as a home CTO would be very, very small. How do you identify that as something that could very meaningfully impact the product itself?
I think there may not be a majority in the population, but there were a very large percentage of our user base.
Right.
So we did cluster analysis where we grouped people based on their attributes of how tech savvy they are, how security conscious they are, how privacy conscious they are, how if they have an issue, where do they take their machine. And those clusters actually came out pretty separated. So just through some of the questionnaires that we've ran and all of the data that we've collected, it was pretty clear. Now, again, it was also not an overnight process. That took us a couple of months to come down to actual definition of these personas. And then everybody started talking about them across the company. But it was a lot of trial and error. And it was a lot of, okay, we need to have additional survey, or we need to do a different type of clustering analysis to really figure out where the cluster epicenters are and how separated they are from each other. So there, it's very distinct use cases as opposed to something that is very closely resonated with each other. But a lot of trial and error, a lot of data work that was done by our research to really get there. And then we overlaid our hypothesis against on top of it, because we had these attributes of people, and how do we name them? How do we actually describe them? Is something that we overlaid on top to humanize it as much as possible. And we still, even for the user base, we don't know if a home CTO is signing up for our product. It's not something that we ask, are you home CTO? But you can actually see it from the feature usage and how they interact with the product if they are a target persona. And that's the important piece. So it wasn't so much about how to necessarily change the view of the product or onboarding. It was more about understanding who's using it so we can develop appropriately all of the new detections or all of the new experiences.
Sure. And Malwarebytes, much like SurveyMonkey, has a freemium model. Mm-hmm. So how did your work at SurveyMonkey inform how you thought about freemium at Malwarebytes?
Yeah, I had a lot of people ask me, why would you go from a survey industry, which is a true SaaS product, to installation-based product in cybersecurity? Like, the industries are so different.
Yeah.
However, the piece that that is exactly the same between the two companies, they're both freemium, and they're both self-serve, and they're both subscription as a service.
Right.
So it's to me, though, that's a skeleton. Mm-hmm. What's on top of that skeleton in terms of the industry is actually, it's super fun to learn, because that's the challenge to really understand why people are doing it. But the fact that they're both self-serve, so you actually have to engage with the customer directly. Nobody's going to do it besides your product. So that tech experience that you're delivering to them has to be flawless, has to be amazing, has to be delightful, has to be easy. Sure. That's the commonality. And it's a consumer at the end of the day, even SurveyMonkey. It's consumers within business, a lot of its use cases. It's definitely selling into businesses, and Malwarebytes is definitely selling into businesses directly through the enterprise. But what I've always worked on is that consumer relationship. So at SurveyMonkey, yes, they were mostly using it for business, but still, it's a consumer-like behavior. At Malwarebytes, it was a true consumer product where it's actual people using it for personal bases. And to me, to apply that skeleton of how do you acquire a consumer? How do you onboard them? How do you activate them? How do you convert them? How do you re-engage them? How do you show them value? That skeleton is exactly the same. You just apply it to a different industry. Sure. Learning cybersecurity industry is something that I think everybody should work at a cybersecurity company for at least 3 months, because the things that you learn about actually what's happening are mind-boggling, and everybody should have that information and awareness at least, even if they decide not to do anything about it. Know the power there, and what's happening is absolutely astonishing in the space, and it's evolving so fast. But the skeleton of it, of providing cybersecurity offering in very approachable consumer-like fashion with an enterprise-grade engine in the back end, is something that resonated with me a lot between both SurveyMonkey and Malwarebytes. So I try to focus always on self-serve businesses, because I love working with them. Whether it's a B2C to B or true B2C. And I love working on subscription products, because I love showing the value to drive recurring revenue. And that's a fun challenge to solve of showing monetary value and connecting it with the customer value, so sure. They feel it's worth actually engaging with your product.
Sure. And now I have to ask you this, because you mentioned this about the cybersecurity space. What were some of the things that astonished you? And not to put words in your mouth, but what were some of the crazy things that you saw that really, really surprised you about the cybersecurity space? Yeah.
To me, the biggest one is that everybody still believes viruses are a thing. In fact, viruses make up less than 3% of the landscape. What you have is a lot of trackers and malware that steal your information and either resell it on in the different marketplace, or actually hack your experiences and the products and steal information directly from you. And they hold you ransom, paying them money to release you from their grips. So just this misconception that viruses is something that we have to worry about. I know viruses is a lot easier to imagine for us because it's virus. But malware, it's a much bigger category. It's a much more threatening category, and it's a lot more destructive of the category in terms of what actually happens with your device. And if you have no, although a lot of operating systems have started clamping down and really providing a lot more security features, still having products that are cybersecurity products on your machine is important. It's absolutely needed. Otherwise, you're just airing your laundry to the world, and somebody's probably taking advantage of it, and you don't even know.
One of the things that I'm very ignorant about and that I need to educate myself about, that I will make sure I do.
And that Windows is not the major problem. There's just as much malware on Macs as there is Windows. It's different type for sure, but the fact that you feel protected by using Mac is a myth in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Okay. Something for me to research and for our listeners to research as their homework after this interview. Excellent. Alina, and after Malwarebytes, now you've moved on to becoming a growth advisor. Can you tell us about what you do and what a typical engagement looks like and what sort of companies you work with?
Yeah, I do love working with freemium self-serve SaaS companies. I love working on freemium because I love unlocking virality and doing a product-led growth acquisition for the companies. I love working self-serve because then I actually have to make sure that each experience is top-notch in order for them to engage with the product in self-serve. And SaaS is just something subscription. Model has always just been at the core of everything that that I've learned throughout my career. And advising for me, I decided to go really because there's so many companies in this freemium subscription self-serve space that started a couple of years ago, maybe like 5 to 10 years ago, because recurring revenue became a really hot topic. Freemium became a hot topic of ability to land customers without any barriers. And a lot of them hit product market fit, and now they're scaling. And I do see a big gap in terms of people that know how to scale those types of businesses to the next level as they unlock their next horizon of product development or new markets or new features or whatever is it that they're working on. So I find it super interesting how you can apply pattern match and apply these learnings between different companies across different industries and really either A, create leaders within organizations that can actually go on and lead those products and scale them appropriately, but B, to help a company scale to that next level and not stall in growth, or if they're stalling in growth, understanding why they're stalling in growth. And even in Silicon Valley, there's very limited expertise that is available that worked at the scaled companies and has a couple years of experience. And I find it just very rewarding to go and help businesses reach that next scale and really land as profitably as possible, expand and have a product-led growth business that becomes extremely lucrative, because not only it's high growth because it's so easy to use, but most importantly, it's profitable at the same time. So that is something that is just the type of puzzles that I love to solve.
Absolutely. And in many ways, you're giving back to the companies that you're going to be working with in terms of sharing your expertise, sharing everything you have known and learned over the years. Alina, can you tell our listeners how we can find out more about you?
Feel free to ping me on LinkedIn. I'll promise I will respond very quickly, or just reach out to me at Can I actually give you my email address, because I'm more than happy to share it as well. LinkedIn is the best way to get in touch with me, and we can go and take the conversation from there.
Fabulous. Elena, this has been an incredible honor. Thank you again for being on How Things Grow. I'm excited to put your interview out into the world very soon.
All right. Thank you so much.
Hey, guys. This is Shamant again. Before you go, I have a small but very important favor to ask. If you get any pleasure or inspiration from this episode, could you please leave a review on your favorite podcasting platform, be it iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast fix? This podcast is very much a labor of love. It makes no money, and each episode takes many, many hours to put together. When you leave a rating or write a review, it not only means a great deal of encouragement to me, but it also supports getting the word out about How Things Grow. Thank you again for listening. And I look forward to seeing you with the next episode. Thank you.